is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on African News Tonight.
The country, with a population of 2 million people, has now recorded more than 3,000 cases from more than 222,000 COVID-19 tests. The number of new daily cases has surged since August.
That's Mokondisi Dube reporting on the Botswana COVID-19 outbreak. Details coming up. Also, in the Gambia, the government has announced the reopening of schools. Talks between the two warring parties in Libya continue, and prosecutors in South Africa push ahead on a corruption probe. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Botswana is recording a surge in COVID-19 cases just months after the Southern African country was lauded for its efforts to keep the virus at bay. Daily recorded infections have jumped to more than 100 in the past 10 days. Botswana has eased pandemic restrictions, but recently extended a state of emergency meant to fight infections to March next year. From Habrone, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana COVID-19 Task Force Deputy Chairperson Professor Mosepile Mosepile says the numbers have risen significantly in recent weeks. The country, with a population of 2 million people, has now recorded more than 3,000 cases from more than 222,000 COVID-19 tests. The number of new daily cases has surged since August.
This marks a significant increase in our cases, where we registered about 20 cases per month back in August. And then beginning in September, in the early part of the month, we were registering 40 cases that crept up to close to 70 and then above 100. Hence why we have an average of about 100 cases per day for the past 10 days, really making a significant change in burden of disease locally.
Botswana lifted lockdown restrictions in May when COVID-19 cases were below 100. Despite easing restrictions, the country remains under a state of emergency, which was recently extended by 6 months to next March. President Mokgweetsi Masisi defended the decision to extend the state of emergency.
It is regrettable that we have of late experienced an exponential rise in local transmissions after the lifting of movement restrictions on the 22nd of May 2020, mainly in the Greater Gaborone Zone. Particularly disturbing is that from July to August 2020, the number of local transmission cases surpassed the number of imported ones.
Schools remain open despite education sector unions calling for their closure to protect students and staff. Many parents like Mpo Marubing say the government should close schools to protect learners.
The virus is now everywhere. The only logical thing is to close the schools. Our children are at risk.
The virus has claimed the lives of 18 residents since March. For VOA, this is Mokondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
In the Gambia, the government has announced the reopening of schools which have been closed for months following the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic. As Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, the education ministry says there are positive signs as far as the country's efforts to combat the deadly pandemic.
The first case of the new coronavirus was found in the Gambia on March 17. The country has since recorded 3,613 positive cases of COVID-19. Out of that number, 117 have died. Schools were closed as part of measures to prevent the spread of the virus. Claudia Nicole is Gambia's Minister for Basic and Secondary Education.
Now that we are beginning to understand the virus and seeing positive signs in our country's effort to contain the pandemic, as well as having learned and gained some lessons and experiences from the partial school reopening, the Ministry of Basic and Secondary Education is determined to reopen schools under strict conditions based on the advice of the Ministry of Health and WHO agreed international standards.
Cole spoke on Tuesday during a national state broadcast. She has called on parents to get their children prepared for school reopening.
In light of the above, I am pleased to inform all students, teachers, parents, and stakeholders that schools will reopen for grades 7 to 12 on October 14th, 2020, and for ECDs to grade 6 on October 28th, 2020.
The education minister says the safety of students is paramount and therefore notes that the COVID-19 safety protocols will be enforced. She says mask wearing will be mandatory in schools and social distancing will be observed.
Being cognizant of the multiple benefits of face-to-face learning against the risks posed by the spread of COVID-19, the ministry intends to complement the reopening of schools with a recovery strategy by promoting reduced class sizes, the distant learning initiatives, extended school days, double shifting.
While the students were out of school, the government organized radio and television classes for them. The education minister has thanked parents for encouraging children to take part in that distant learning program. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
While talks between representatives of the two warring parties in Libya continue, the military state of play on the ground remains fluid. The two sides are facing off around Sirte. Experts say for a stable ceasefire, backers of the two sides must refrain from sending reinforcements and the Libyan factions must accept independent monitoring. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the situation with Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
It's certainly not a sustainable calm for the time being. While the Libyan National Army currently does not have the required offensive capabilities to attack Tripoli or Tripolitania again, they would probably do so if they would feel strong enough in the future. But without significant more support by an external power like Egypt or Russia, this is highly unlikely to happen. And none of these two nations is willing to provide them the capability. On the other side, Turkish-supported Operation Volcano has offensive capabilities sufficient to defeat the Libyan National Army if Egypt stays out. And Turkey is aware of this. So I don't think that they are very sympathetic to an offensive right now. But especially radical Islamist groups like the various Shura councils from the east could easily try to trigger a larger offensive and try to drag Turkey into the fight, especially by, for example, a successful attack, lightning attack on the Al-Jufra oasis. To conclude, if there is no international supervision or better international enforcement, the current situation is a road to renewed fighting. Even if, as discussed in Hurghada, a joint Libyan police force would deploy to Sirte, they would be no deterrence to any of the two sides. And severe violations of the ceasefire could undermine the current positive political process. And there are groups on both sides, who want to undermine this process.
So under what circumstances would the two sides agree to a stable ceasefire and who could be accepted by both sides as a monitor?
For the warring factions, it is quite clear that such an international monitoring of the ceasefire would most likely mean the end for any ambitions to conquer the whole country by force once and for all. And therefore, the Libyan National Army and Operation Volcano will only accept if they really see and understand that there is no option for them to defeat the other side on the battlefield, or if they are forced to do so by their international supporters. But for the time being, I'm not so sure that they are already there. So it would be necessary also for the United States to push their international key supporters, namely Egypt, Emirates, Turkey, and Russia, to push the both sides. I would say Egypt is probably supportive as sustainable ceasefire would ensure the Egyptian national interests in Libya. Turkey would only support such an initiative if they realize that there is really no way for a successful offensive. And I would say there is probably some international pressure required to convince them that's a role for the United States. For Turkey, it is key that any future solution maintains the unity of Libya because of their own maritime claims related to Libya. And I would say this is a reasonable argument. The radical Islamists supporting Operation Volcano and some hawkish LNA commanders from the West will probably never, ever accept. But I would not say that they have a veto right on this. A Libyan invitation by an appropriate body, for example, the House of Representatives and the Supreme State Council and a UN mandate, would be required to launch such an operation. Who should monitor it? Simply sending observers won't be enough. A credible force, a credible military force is required. The United Nations would need probably several months to deploy, but if they are there and if they have a proper composition of the force, which is not the case in all the theaters they are engaged in, they would be certainly sufficient. The European Union could provide the initial entry force, but you know, not every European nation would be accepted by the Libyans because of their alignment with one or the other sides. Currently, the European Union has two so-called EU battle groups on standby. They could be on the ground within 10 days. One is led by Italy, one is led by Germany. Germany is perceived as neutral in the conflict. Germany has a very good reputation among many Libyans. Germany is a leading EU nation and currently a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. They have a high credibility. So if Germany would decide to deploy on the invitation of the Libyans with a UN mandate, their battle group to Libya, I cannot imagine a situation where Turkey or Egypt would dare to attack German soldiers on the ground.
That was Wolfgang Pashtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. In South Africa, evidence at a commission of inquiry into corruption has linked one of the ruling African National Congress's most senior official to a project that resulted in the theft of hundreds of millions of rands. And over the past few days, ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule has said he expects to be arrested at any moment. However, police and investigators have indicated Magashule will remain free for now. Many South Africans are concerned that President Cyril Ramaphosa's war on graft will allow senior ruling party members to escape. But as Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg, prosecutors say it's not that simple.
7 years ago, Ace Magashule was premier of Free State Province, and his office gave the green light to two companies to remove asbestos from houses across the province. State prosecutors say the companies did work worth 20 million rand, but were paid 230 million rand, about $15 million. Many Free State residents still live in homes containing dangerous asbestos fibers. Seven serving and former government officials and businessmen have been arrested in the case on charges including fraud and money laundering. Magashule is not among them. Advocate Hermian Cronier is lead investigator for the National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA. She says bringing charges isn't always clear-cut.
Our job is to establish cases that we can take to court. So verify the evidence, make sure that it will be admissible in a court, and make sure that we put together indictments that we are confident will result in convictions.
Magashule says no evidence of graft will ever be found against him because he's never been corrupt. Still, some citizens have wondered why Magashule has not been charged in the case when those around him have been. Cronier, however, cannot speak about individual investigations.
I'm certainly not saying an individual is going to be on a charge sheet or not on a charge sheet. That will be determined by our ability to turn evidence into admissible evidence before a court.
Previous corruption cases linked to Magashule have collapsed because of poorly done investigations. Cronier and her team are treading carefully because they don't want this to happen again.
One of the big challenges that we have had is that there's a mountain of evidence. There are hundreds of people implicated. And so we are required to be fairly strategic about how we approach these prosecutions, how we sequence them, who is charged together with which group.
The Commission of Inquiry on Corruption said there's strong evidence that at least one corrupt payment from the asbestos project was channeled through Magashule's office. Cronier says that's not enough to charge him at this stage.
Charging someone is a very serious matter and has very serious consequences for that individual. So there is a threshold, and I can assure you when that threshold is reached, charges will follow.
Cronier acknowledges the NPA faces an immense task in trying to successfully prosecute powerful individuals.
We are also operating in a climate where the law enforcement has almost no credibility. So we have had to make sure when we put these indictments together that they signal to people that we mean business, that we are not just arresting for the sake of arresting. We're not arresting because we are being put under pressure to arrest. We're arresting because we've done the homework.
The advocate says so much corruption happened under former President Jacob Zuma that she and her investigators are buried in evidence. They've had to build the process and capability to properly investigate cases. Even so, some legal analysts say the NPA must prioritize some cases over others. So there's a good chance that many allegedly corrupt individuals will never be charged. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa's economy was brought close to a standstill today as workers affiliated with the country's two biggest unions took to the streets protesting against corruption and unemployment. The South African Congress of Trade Unions, COSATU, a partner of the ruling African National Congress and the South African Federation of Trade Unions, asked the 3 million members in both the private and public sector to either stay at home or join street marches. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In cities across the country, workers filled the streets with motorcades and picketed in front of government offices, demanding swift action on their grievances. It is a long list. Government corruption, the failing economy, the loss of jobs, the government's failure to increase civil service salaries, and escalating gender-based violence are just the top priorities. Begin Jalinjali is the General Secretary of the South African Congress of Trade Unions. He said workers can no longer fold their hands and wallow in poverty while those in government loot state resources.
The main cause of this thing to us, besides the question of COVID, is corruption. We stand up, join the other forces and say we must end up corruption. People who are involved in corruption must be arrested and they must go to jail.
An ongoing inquiry into state capture and corruption has revealed that in the past decade, top government officials, including ministers, pocketed millions of dollars in corrupt deals involving state funds. Noma Shike leads health workers at the Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto, the country's largest.
We are serious about the issues of workers. We need that increase. You can't tell us it will take us 4 years before we'll get an incentive. Are you saying that we should just go deep and deep into poverty as workers?
In Pretoria, workers decided to forget about the COVID-19 dangers as they gathered in their thousands singing, dancing and chanting anti-corruption slogans. Cape Town also saw long motorcades of protesting workers. Some South Africans have criticized unions for calling the workers on the streets at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. However, Malvin De Bruin, COSATU's provincial secretary in the Western Cape, says all precautions were taken.
The appeal was for the majority of our members to stay at home, but we also requested for those with transport to come and join us on the motorcade to town.
Some workers, however, decided to go to work as usual. The strike comes as the economy continues to be battered by pandemic control measures. Hundreds of businesses have shut their doors for good, leaving workers jobless. Statistics South Africa reports that more than 2 million jobs were lost in the second quarter at the height of the pandemic. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A Kenyan court found two men guilty for playing a role in the 2013 terrorist attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall. The men were found guilty of conspiring to and aiding the armed men from the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The court acquitted the third suspect of all charges. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenyan authorities arrested four men in 2013 for allegedly playing roles in the Westgate Mall attack. One was released in January 2019 The other three were in a Nairobi court Wednesday to listen to the verdict of Judge Francis Andai. Andai found Mohamed Abdi and Hussein Mustafa guilty, while Liban Abdullahi was acquitted due to lack of evidence.
In the final analysis, therefore, I find that the prosecution has not proved its case against the second accused person on all the charges that were facing him, and consequently he is acquitted under Section 215 of the Criminal Procedure Code. I am, however, satisfied that the prosecution has proved its case against the first and fourth accused persons on the respective charges facing them herein beyond a reasonable doubt. I find them guilty and convict them accordingly.
Gunmen stormed the busy mall one Saturday in September 2013 and opened fire, killing at least 67 people and injuring more than 150 others. Kenyan authorities said all four attackers were killed in the police and army siege that followed, although some analysts believe the gunmen escaped. The trial of the three men began in early 2019. The court listened to 40 witnesses as the men faced 12 accounts of terrorism-related charges. The judge found that Abdi and Mustafa supported and helped the gunmen who carried out the attack. The court also found the two men owned terrorism materials, knew about the attackers and communicated with the men who carried out the attack. 31-year-old John Wangombe, who worked at the mall, survived the attack. He welcomed the convictions.
That's good news indeed. At trust we have managed to get justice for what we went through in 2013. Although justice has been derailed, we have gotten justice at trust.
Another survivor, 38-year-old Ben Mulwa, was in his vehicle when the gunmen attacked the mall. He abandoned his car, seeking safety, but came face-to-face with one of the attackers, who aimed a gun at him and fired. Miraculously, the gunmen missed. The father of four said Wednesday he is happy with the convictions.
We may never fully recover from either the injuries or the scars or even recover the lives that we lost, but I believe it is a good step in the right direction and also a consolation to a majority of those who survived the incident.
Mulwa says this conviction can help Kenyan youth who engage in terrorism to think about their future.
It is a very significant good step in the right direction because it shows commitment mostly from the part of the government to pursue justice. And I hope that especially our young people get excited into the radicalization by terrorist outfits, can see that this is a deterrent, and ultimately you may engage yourself in criminal activities that amount to nothing.
The judge will sentence the convicts later this month. The two men are facing jail time of up to 20 years. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyus Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here.